Thanks for joining us this afternoon on KGOU. I'm Jim Johnson with today's Sunday Radio Matinee feature. The United States and Iran have been at odds for quite some time now, and tensions between the two nations have heightened in recent weeks, prompting more and more discussions across the country on the origins of these tensions and what the future may hold. Such was the focus of a February 3rd public forum held at the Sam Noble Oklahoma Museum of Natural History in Norman and sponsored by the University of Oklahoma's Center for Middle East Studies. The discussion ahead features an expert on the matter, Trita Parsi, author, analyst, and co-founder and executive director of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Joining the discussion and moderating were Samer Shehada, associate professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and Joshua Landis, professor of Middle Eastern History and the director of the OU Center for Middle East Studies. The forum was titled Iran-U.S. Conflict, What's Next for the Region? Initiating the conversation was guest speaker Trita Parsi. The following has been edited slightly for time.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure being here. Thank you to Marjan for helping organize this, initiating this, and of course to the Farzaneh family for their generosity and supporting a broadened conversation about matters on the Middle East that is so critical for the United States right now. I'll be talking for a couple minutes about the situation with Iran, what has happened, what likely will happen, why it's happening, and what perhaps also can be done about it. Let me start off by just noting a very sad reality. Twice in the last 6 months, the United States and Iran have been less than 10 minutes away from a full-scale war. First in July of last year, when the Iranians shot down an American drone that they said had entered into Iranian territory. Trump had ordered an attack and then changed his mind last minute. And then, of course, a couple of weeks ago, when we had the assassination of Soleimani, an Iranian response, and to the contrary to what a lot of people, including myself, had feared and predicted, this fortunately did not escalate further. But I do not think that we are out of the woods, and let me explain why. The reason why we have seen in the last 40 years enmity, but in the last 6 months, two near war moments, is because of the fact that the Trump administration pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018, reimposed sanctions, decided to impose what they called maximum pressure, the calculation being that had the Obama administration just pursued sanctions for 6 more months against Iran before they started negotiating the nuclear deal, the Iranians would have capitulated because their economy would have collapsed. So Trump's advisors, who knew very well that a winning argument for him would have been to say, this is how you outdo the previous president, argued that if you impose maximum pressure and sanction the country, obliterating their economy, essentially, the Iranians will collapse and they will be forced to come back to the table and essentially offer their capitulation. This is why the Trump administration itself occasionally refers to their sanctions strategy as economic warfare, because that is exactly what it is. The question is, why, on what premise do we believe that we can pursue economic warfare without risking it bleeding into military warfare, which is exactly what we almost have done twice now. Let me give you a couple of statistics. As a result of these sanctions, the Iranians were producing roughly 3.8 million barrels of oil a day prior to the reimposition of sanctions. Once Trump initiated his first sanctions, the Iranian production went down to 2.1 million. They were exporting 2.3 before. That went down to about 1 million barrels a day. The Iranians at that moment, this is what happened in 2018, calculated that they still could withstand that pressure and opted to stay inside of the nuclear deal, continue to abide by it, even though the U.S. had breached it, walked out of it, and started to punish Iran through these different sanctions. Part of the calculation was, well, the Europeans are going to be able to come in, replace the U.S., the Iranian economy will suffer, but the Europeans will help soften the blow. That did not happen. What instead happened was that in May 2019, the Trump administration saw an opportunity because of the situation in the international oil markets to completely eliminate Iran's oil exports. So going from 3.8 million barrels a day all the way down to zero. The Trump administration suddenly decided not to renew oil waivers. And with that, Iran lost almost all of its export. It used to be at 2.3. Today, it's estimated at being around 260,000 barrels. That's it. That's more than a 90% drop in their oil exports. This has had an absolutely devastating effect on their economy, which, mindful of their own mismanagement, their own corruption, is making it even more painful. And those who tend to feel most of that pain, of course, are ordinary people. At this moment, when Trump succeeded in essentially eliminating all of their oil exports, that's when the Iranians started to recognize they're not going to be able to sustain this. This is starting to become an existential threat. And part of the challenge they had was that the strategy they had pursued, which was to continue to stay in the deal, meant that almost all of the cost and all of the risk of Trump's sanctions policy fell on Iran. This was not economically costly to the U.S. This certainly was not politically costly to the U.S., nor was it economically or politically costly to the Saudis, to the UAE, to the Europeans, or those states that had helped enable that sanctions policy. So they decided that now they're going to try to spread that risk around. They're going to resist and make it more costly for the United States to pursue that economic warfare. At first, that meant that they're going to restart aspects of their nuclear program. And that's what they moved to do. So some of their commitments to the nuclear program, they started to say, well, they're going to give up those commitments, restart aspects of it, you know, hold more low-enriched uranium on their soil, etc. That's very, very dangerous, because that means that once again, the Iranian may end up being in a situation in which their breakout capability, meaning their amount of time it would take for them to have the material for the nuclear bomb, would start shrinking again, and that would then create all kinds of problems that actually had been resolved by the nuclear deal. But it turned out that that most likely was not the main track through which they were trying to reduce the risk on their shoulders and spread it around. Because suddenly last summer, we started to see mysterious attacks against oil tankers in the Persian Gulf, in the UAE, and then later on in September, also a brazen attack against oil installations in Saudi Arabia that temporarily took out half of Saudi Arabia's oil production, which is roughly 5% of the world's oil production. At this moment, now we don't have clear evidence that it was the Iranians, but quite a lot indicates that if it wasn't originating from Iranian territory, they certainly had something to do with it. Now, this changed the entire picture, because now suddenly pursuing economic warfare against Iran carried the cost for the UAE, carried the cost for the Europeans, carried the cost for the Saudis, and also for the United States, mindful of the fact that an American drone got shot down. And at this point, this is when we see the gravitation of the United States and Iran towards conflict, because once they start resisting the economic warfare, that's exactly when we start moving closer towards military warfare. Now, in July, when they shot down that drone, the official story is that Trump ordered the attack. 10 minutes before they were supposed to take off, he called it off. And he says on TV it's because he spoke to generals who said, well, this response would cause roughly 150 casualties on the Iranian side. And Trump decided that that would be a disproportionate response to the fact that the Iranians shot down an unmanned drone, meaning no casualties on the American side. There is a different narrative, which is that this had far less to do with his concern about Iranian casualties and far more to do with the fact that the Iranians sent a message through the Swiss, who are the intermediaries oftentimes between the U.S. and Iran, that if the U.S. responded militarily and attacked Iran on Iranian soil, the Iranians would respond disproportionately, meaning all-out war. mindful of the implications of that, there's good reasons to believe that Trump, partly for political reasons, decided not to go further. This sent shockwaves through some of the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf, though, because it meant that their belief, their hope, that the United States would defend them with its military against Iran in case of a war, did not seem to be likely because Trump was unwilling to go to war with Iran on behalf of the UAE or Saudi Arabia. And I'll get back to why that is significant later on, perhaps in the Q&A. But once we got to the situation with Soleimani, there is a perception that the Iranians responded. They struck an American base. They gave a heads up to the US through the Iraqis before, which likely reduced the number of casualties on the American side. At first, we heard that there was no one. Now we know that roughly 64 people had to be flown to Germany for brain injuries as a result of the attack. But the perception was, well, this was not as harsh of a reaction as many had expected. Perhaps the Iranians were deterred. Perhaps the United States managed to reestablish its deterrence against Iran, mindful of the fact that it didn't do anything after the drone. I think that is a very, very misleading, if not incorrect, conclusion of what happened. First of all, it is true. What Trump did was unprecedented. The United States has had the opportunity to assassinate Soleimani before. The reason why previous administrations, Bush and Obama, chose not to do so was precisely because of the escalatory risk that such a measure would carry. And this was something that went well beyond what the Iranians had expected. But what the Iranians did was also something that went well beyond what anything they had done before. Because they responded by directly attacking an American base from their own territory, not using any proxies or anything of that kind. And while the official story is that they gave a heads up that ensured, more or less, that there would not be any American deaths, when you talk to the American military, they're not so convinced that that is the reason. Because they say if the Iranians really wanted to make sure, 100% certain, that there would be no American deaths, they would have used cruise missiles that have far greater precision. Instead, they used ballistic missiles, which meant that they had some degree of precision, but it could very well ended up somewhere else, and it could have ended up killing 100 Americans. So it may have been more luck than design as to why there was no American deaths in that attack. Keep in mind what happened in Syria, and Joshua would know much more about it, but when the United States struck the Russians there, and what was it, 70 or so killed? More than that. The Russians did nothing in response. The Iranians did, and it could very well have ended up killing a lot of Americans. So if anything, I don't think either the Iranians or the US can say that deterrence has been reestablished. What has been established is that if we pursue economic warfare, and if that begets American resistance from the Iranians, that only means that we are getting more and more close to an actual military confrontation. And here's why I think this current pause is somewhat misleading. We should not think that the situation is completely resolved at this point. And that is because the driving forces of this conflict have not in any way, shape, or form been addressed. The United States is still pursuing economic warfare, putting more pressure on the Iranian economy. The Iranians are resisting that more aggressively than they did before. That has already led to one potential skirmish. And on top of that, now we have another arena, which is Iraq. A lot of attention has been given to the fact that Soleimani was assassinated. Less attention has been given to the fact that Abu Muhandis was also one of the people that was killed in that attack, and he's a head of a major Iraqi paramilitary group. The Iraqis may choose to avenge his death by attacking American troops in Iraq. What will the Trump administration do? How will they read that measure if it occurs? Will they blame that on that specific Iraqi militia, or will they see that as being triggered, ordered, or facilitated by Iran? So even if the US doesn't want to escalate further, even if the Iranians don't want to escalate further, if actors in Iraq do something against American troops, that may still also lead to another potential for war between the United States and Iran. Nothing has been done to address any of these issues. And so as a result, I'm very worried and concerned that as we just continue with this situation, within the next 3 to 6 months, there will likely be another moment in which the pressure and counter-pressure or some measure by an Iraqi militia in Iraq against American troops will once again put the United States and Iran moments away from a major war. In my view, we have lucked out twice in a row now. Can we count on being lucky 3 times in a row? I don't believe that that's where we should put our bets. What is needed right now is real, proper, de-escalatory diplomacy. And unfortunately, the institutions, the individuals that under normal circumstances, or at least 30 years ago, would conduct these things are not in existence right now. And I'll close it on this. If this happened 30 years ago, the UN Secretary General would be on an airplane between Tehran and Washington, back and forth, mediating and trying to find a solution to the crisis. That is not taking place right now because of the weakness of the UN, which has many different causes. Instead, we're dependent on political leaders in various countries who may have the opportunity and the political capital to be able to step in. And if they don't, we have nothing. So at times we've been lucky. President Macron of France have tried to step in and mediate. Japan's Abe has tried to mediate. But that standing institution whose job it is to help resolve these tensions, whose job it is to make sure that if there is a lull in fighting, they take advantage of that to do true de-escalation, we do not have that right now. And that is creating an even more dangerous situation, in my view. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Trita. I largely agree with Trita on the general points that have been made, and in fact, on many of the specific points. I do think that the policy of maximum leverage, maximum pressure has been a failed policy. I think if we look in the past with regard to the sanctions regime on Cuba or the sanctions on Iraq, for example, even if we look at the sanctions on South Africa carefully and we realize the importance of armed struggle in producing the end of apartheid, we come to the conclusion quite quickly that sanctions rarely work, and in fact, they produce maximum pain on innocent populations. And that's really what's happening with regard to Iran. I do take issue, though, with a few things. I'm in complete agreement that the Trump administration's policy with regard to Iran and with regard to many other matters in the Middle East has been a complete failure, if not a disaster. We only saw last week the Jared Kushner deal of the century with regard to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which really is absurd, and so on. However, I do give more credit to the Iranians with regard to their ability to restrain themselves and their knowledge of the asymmetry in the relationship between the United States and Iran, and credit to their retaliation, which was measured and had the intention of being retaliatory but not escalatory. And in fact, I think it was quite successful, much better than, in fact, American efforts to do so. So I take issue with the idea that we really were 10 minutes away twice in terms of a major all-out war with Iran. The Iranians realize, of course, that they're not capable of having an all-out war with the United States that leads to success. And their actions then are based on that premise. The primary victims of a war with Iran would actually not be Americans. They would be Americans in the region, that is the American military in Bahrain, the Fifth Fleet, CENTCOM in Qatar, as well as the populations of those countries. And as Trita mentioned, because they're much closer, not to mention American military forces elsewhere in the region, and as Trita also noted correctly, we saw something very interesting in the aftermath of the Qasem Soleimani assassination, and that's what it was. We saw states like Saudi Arabia, who have been leading the march against Iran, call for restraint, because they realized quite well that they would be on the front lines of any kind of escalation between the United States and Iran. I will, though, say one other thing, if that's okay, my colleague and friend here on the right, Joshua. That is that we do need to understand a larger point. And in some senses, what I'm about to say adds to what Shrita was saying, that makes the situation even more complicated than the already complex situation that he's put forward. And that is the context of not only who Qasem Soleimani was, but the more important point of Iran's role in the region. Not to mention the situation within Iran in terms of the human rights abuses and the lack of political freedoms and a regime that has a miserable human rights record. I am one of the advisors for Freedom House, which is a nonpartisan organization that tries to measure the levels of freedom around the world and so on, with one being the highest level of freedom, Norway, Sweden, the United States, and seven being the lowest level of freedom. I advise them with regard to the Middle East. There are some countries in the region we need to spend 5 minutes only examining their human rights record. Saudi Arabia always gets a 7 out of 7. I wish my lottery tickets were just as easy to predict. Iran also always gets a 7 out of 7. Because the human rights record is quite miserable. So we need to understand not only that, but we also need to understand Iran's less than stellar, if not quite deadly, regional policy, and in particular, Qasem Soleimani's role in that. And this gets us to the perspective of the Arab states and Arab populations with regard to the assassination. Because if you are in Riyadh, or if you are in Abu Dhabi, or maybe even Cairo, or Amman, you look at Qasem Soleimani as the mastermind behind Iran's regional expansionist or strive for hegemony. You look at what's happened in Syria over the last 5 or 6 years, and with the industrial killing machine of Bashar al-Assad, and who is to thank for that? Certainly Vladimir Putin has facilitated that significantly, but Iran has as well, and in particularly Qasem Soleimani. When you look at the situation in Yemen, if you are in Riyadh or if you are in Abu Dhabi, and this isn't necessarily my perspective, but this is their perspective, you look at Iran, and the Saudis and the Emiratis deserve a huge amount of blame, but you also, from their perspective, look at Iran as being a party to the conflict, a facilitator of the continuing violence in Yemen. If you look at the situation in Iraq, right, if you are in the Arab world and so on, you see that Iran has come to dominate Iraqi politics. And it's quite ironic, in fact, that the Trump administration, in taking out Qasem Soleimani, has also led to the decline in huge protests that were taking place in Iraq, criticizing the government for its poor governance and for its corruption and for the overbearing role of Iran in Iraqi politics, right? You see similar situation in Lebanon. So my point is that Iranian regional policy, from the perspective of many, has also not been one of facilitating human rights or freedom or even peace and security. And I don't mean this only as a way to defend the Trump administration by any means. That's not what I'm getting at. But what I would like to say is that the situation is even more complicated because we're not dealing with someone wearing a white hat and someone wearing a black hat. We're looking at and dealing with two states and their foreign policies, which have been quite disastrous for millions of people in the region. And maybe I will stop there and turn things over to my Princeton colleague, Joshua Landis.
I'd like to make just two points. One is a point about U.S. foreign policy, which is that the U.S., the Trump administration, seems to embrace the view that Iran is a hegemon that's about to dominate the Middle East, and it needs to be driven out of the region. Now, I'd like to try to explore for a few seconds on what that might be based, because Iran is a country of about 90 million people. It has a GDP of less than $400 billion, but its military budget is about $16 billion a year. It does not have an Air Force worth talking about. The United States had provided an Air Force for Iran under the Shah, but since then it has not been able to acquire an Air Force. It does have very good missile technology where it's tried to make up for its deficit in traditional military means. For example, it doesn't have tanks like Saudi Arabia, the Abrams tanks, or Israel, so forth. But if you add up the other side of the ledger, that's Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, who make up the anti-Iranian bloc. Their military spending is about 5 times Iran's. Their population, collectively, is about 100 million. And their GDP is well over 4 times Iran's. Iran is really a pipsqueak in this, well, let me not say pipsqueak, but Iran is incapable of conquering the Middle East or dominating the Middle East. And you look at its allies that are seen to be these specters of danger. Syria, a broken country whose national budget was $9 billion this year, with $1 billion to reconstruct a country that the UN estimates needs $300 billion to reconstruct. Lebanon, which is going through a financial crisis and has just collapsed. The Lebanese pound lost more than a third of its value over the last month. And Iran itself, an economy that's struggling. Iraq, complete chaos. These are the countries, Yemen, these are the countries that are theoretically going to be the launching pads for dominating the Middle East. They're not launching pads. Why is the America so frightened of Iran? Which would help us explain why the United States has given Saudi Arabia a big pass, why Kushner is trying to patch up relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel. And in a sense, what we see is the Israeli plan that he has come up with is he has bought, in a sense, Saudi support for his Israeli plan by saying, we're going to go after Iran. And Saudi Arabia has been, to a large degree, compliant because it sees in this the advantage of the United States really sticking it to its enemy, Iran. This is the American foreign policy against Iran, and it's hard to see why so much capital. We just threatened Europe with tariffs on their cars coming into the United States if they didn't comply with our sanctions on Iran. Second point. What if the United States wins? What if it gets what it wants? What if it does bring Iran to its knees? Which is a large and very possible. I don't think Iran has been doing well. I think Iran has been losing. If we look at the two quotes from top Iranians, the president, Hassan Rouhani, said a year and some months ago when sanctions were reimposed, he said, if one day they want to prevent the export of Iran's oil from the Persian Gulf, then no oil will be exported from the Persian Gulf. This was his threat. And I think he thought, well, if we hit the Saudis and take out half of their production, the oil price will go through the roof. President Trump will be fearful that world economy will tip, and he'll lose the elections. But none of that happened. Fracking has been so successful, putting 4 million barrels a day of extra oil on the market, making America the biggest producer of oil for the first time in decades. And it's flooded the market. Oil is at $50 a barrel today. It's less than the water you get at the Walmart. Rouhani's strategy has failed. He couldn't. And America's put 4,000 more troops into Saudi Arabia in order to threaten Iran and say, you do that again and we're going to smash you. That bringing up our average, our total troops that are surrounding Iran to about 60,000. Then the second quote is from Zarif, the foreign minister, who said, President Trump cannot expect to be unpredictable and expect others to be predictable. Unpredictability will lead to mutual unpredictability. And unpredictability is chaotic. That's what he said a little less than a year ago, saying, look, if America thinks they can starve us to death, we're going to hit them where they don't expect it. Whether it's in Saudi Arabia, whether it's in the Persian Gulf, whether it's in Iraq, we can be the masters of indirection and sneaky surprise. But it's not turning out very well for Iran. President Trump is using his, you know, crazy man in the crazy uncle in the attic strategy, which is to be unpredictable, just the way Zarif said. But he's willing to be unpredictable and be chaotic. The thing is, America can succeed. Look at what we've done to Afghanistan. Look at what we've done to Iraq. Look at Libya. It's cost America a great deal. There have been Americans who have been hurt, wounded, killed, but it's hardly made a flesh wound in America. But look at the region. Look what the Iraqis have suffered, the hundreds of thousands. Look what Yemen is going through right now with constant warfare, ripped apart. And in Afghanistan, here we are 18 years later talking about withdrawing. So the entire government that we've established will possibly collapse, and everything will go back to Taliban rule. And all of this killing will be for nothing. We can crush Iran. It's easy. It's not as easy as it was 60 years ago when we took out Mossadegh for $3 million. No, it's costing us trillions of dollars to do this. But the United States can still destroy a fairly weak nation. And what would happen if we do it, if we succeed in crumbling the government, in provoking giant demonstrations? We're likely to get civil war. That's what we've gotten in Iraq. That's what we got in Syria. That's what we got in Libya. We're not going to get the son of the Shah going back there and taking over. We're not going to get human rights. None of that's going to happen. It's going to be much worse human rights. Because that's been the record. Look at every country that America has crushed. It's horrible. It's nothing like the human rights violations that go on in Iran or Saudi Arabia or any of the other countries, or even under Assad before the war. So I guess those are the two points that I would make, is that America can win. We're big. And it hardly hurts us, but we can sow chaos. The refugees will come spurting out, and it won't bother America. That's why Europe is terrified of Iran policy, because those Iranians are going to go to Europe. They're going to go to Turkey. They're going to go to the neighbors, just the way the Syrians have, or the Libyans. America can sit over here and close its borders and say no immigration. It's easy. And for those reasons, I think that it really is not in the interest of the United States to pursue this kind of policy. It's easy, but it's not good, either for the United States or for the region.
You're listening to Iran-U.S. Conflict, What's Next for the Region, a public forum presented by the OU Center for Middle East Studies and held on the evening of February 3rd at the Sam Noble Oklahoma Museum of Natural History. The presenters are Samer Shehata, Associate Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and Joshua Landis, Professor of Middle Eastern History and Director of the OU Center for Middle East Studies. Joining them is guest speaker and executive director of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Trita Parsi. At this point in the presentation, the three speakers took audience questions.
I'm Charles Kimball, head of religious studies at OU, and Middle East is my area as well. My question is really one asking for your best guess, speculation. You noted that Iraqis had said that Soleimani was perhaps involved in carrying a message back and forth. What do you think, any of you or all of you, was the primary motivation or maybe multiple motivations for the timing of taking out Soleimani? A distraction, disrupting that back and forth? What do you think is likely the best explanations for why it happened when it happened?
All right, so this is going to sound very much non-political science-like. But that's because we're dealing with a president in which no political science model has been developed to analyze. I spoke to a person quite close to the president's inner circle, and who mentioned that ever since impeachment began, he had essentially was more or less, I don't know if he used the word panic, but essentially he said he's living the day by day. He's not planning beyond that. It's all about surviving that day, and that this is really taken very, very hard on his psyche. The thing that apparently really frustrated him was that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer were controlling the news cycle during that period. They decided what was in the news, not Donald Trump. And this should not be a particularly important point, frankly. But apparently, according to this source, was really bewildering the president. And that in conversations afterward, after 3 days after the assassination, he was extremely pleased because he was once again in charge of the news cycle. Now, if you take a look at what happened in July when he decided to pull back and not carry forward with the order, there were several people talking to him, pushing him to do it, particularly John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, Haspel at CIA, and several hawkish members of the Senate. But there were also a few individuals who were talking him out of it. And the bottom line was, this is bad for you politically. A very significant portion of your base voted for you because you criticized the Iraq War, you took on the pro-hawkish elements of the Republican Party, and particularly just exposed to Hillary Clinton, who otherwise was known to be quite hawkish. This is why they came to your side. You cannot afford to lose them. You actually have done quite a good job. 2 years have passed. You have not started a new war. George Bush had already had two land invasions of the Middle East by that time. And this is going to play really badly for you politically if you do it. If we assume that that is correct, then the question is, what was the big difference between that in July and January 2020, in which he was willing to do something that apparently some of the generals who had put forward the options in front of him had put it forward, not with the intent of him actually accepting it. It was put forward as, this is the most extreme thing you can do, you should certainly not do it. Yet that's the one he went for. The only thing that seems to have dramatically changed the situation between July and January seems to be impeachment and domestic politics. I have a hard time seeing any other major geopolitical, other type of calculation being the real driver. And particularly when it comes to the idea of timing, keep in mind the ability to be able to target Soleimani had existed on numerous occasions before. It was not that, oh, this is a once in a really blue moon opportunity to do so. Moreover, the original things that had bubbled up and created a problem, which was that one of these Iraqi militias had attacked an American a base, in killing, including one American contractor. The response was to attack them. About 25 or so of them were killed. Their response was to attack and protest outside a U.S. embassy. But those protests were called off a day before the assassination, and they all left. So to go forward with the assassination a day after that and tying it to the attack on the embassy seems to be difficult, mindful of the fact that those protests essentially had ended. The Iraqi government had even announced that those are over with, and the streets were essentially empty. So again, it's difficult to usually political scientists do not like to analyze things at that level and point to factors of that kind, but that seems to be more of a plausible explanation than those others that we see in the media, I think.
Okay, they've just discovered vast new reserves in Iran of oil. It seems like that whole region, Kazakhstan, all of those have gas and oil. What is the implication of the Road and Belt initiative that China's doing? Isn't getting oil from Iran to China just a matter of plumbing?
I think Belt and Road is a real danger for America. Why is it a danger for America? In the same way that America was a danger for Great Britain and France in the Middle East in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. The United States preached open-door policy, free trade, which was the destruction of the British Empire and the French Empire. It was infuriating to France and Britain because it was going to undo the sterling pound block and it was going to undo their empires. And Britain began to respond by doing things like trying to overthrow the Shah of Iran because it was only offering 30% royalties on oil, whereas America was being very generous in offering Saudi Arabia 50%. In Egypt, America didn't want Britain to overthrow Nasser because they thought they could deal with him by building the dam and being Belt and Road and doing America's Belt and Road. Development, my father going to Saudi Arabia and then to Beirut, the banking. Everybody loved Americans because they brought money and they brought development and they brought goodness and they brought education. Look at the American universities across the Middle East. They're still the place that every Middle Eastern wants to study. AUB, 34 prime ministers of the Middle East went to AUB. Bosphorus University, Roberts College in Istanbul, American University in Cairo. America had built schools, it brought good things, it was Belt and Road. And today, China is doing the same thing, and Africa and the Middle East are the beneficiaries of it, and America's furious, and they're worried about it, and they want to stop it. You go to China, you go to Washington, and all you hear now is Belt and Road, China. China, Belt and Road. They don't want to talk to you about Iran. And that's why America is worried. We're the British of the 1940s and 50s who fear that we're going to be turned out of the Middle East because of this very powerful economy that can do things cheaper and isn't doing things with military force.
Hello, my name is Jonathan. I'm a graduate student here in the International Studies program. And my question is, it seems that a lot of America's Middle East strategy has been predicated on controlling the oil market in the world. And it seems that it was a foregone conclusion that protecting the sanctity of the oil market across the world was in America's vital interest. But I believe I saw an article on your Twitter, Professor Landis, where it took dispute with that and was saying that or protecting the oil flow from the Middle East is no longer in America's vital interest. And I was wondering, what is your thoughts on that? And then if that is the case, how should we adjust our strategy in the region?
Yeah, so here I would perhaps differ a little bit with Joshua in the sense that, yes, the United States can and have crushed Iraq, crushed Afghanistan. And while the human cost for the United States here has, of course, been incomparable to the human cost for the Afghanis and for the Iraqis, it has nevertheless cost the United States tremendously because the strength and the rise of China is happening much faster than predicted. And much of it has been precisely because of the fact that they're rising without starting wars, and we're wasting a tremendous amount of energy, resources, goodwill, political capital by waging these wars. And even when the government itself reveals by releasing documents to the Washington Post that almost from the very beginning, the US government knew that it was not going to win in Afghanistan, and that for 18 years it's been lying and deceiving the American people, it was stunning to me how little it stunned the American public. It's almost as if we didn't care that we've been lied to for 18 years. So this has, in deep ways, affected the United States and rendered it less capable of being able to compete. I would agree, though, that the region no longer has that degree of strategic significance as it did when the United States first struck up its relationship with Saudi Arabia. And going back to what Joshua said earlier on, yes, 50% of China's energy is coming from the Persian Gulf. To the extent that China continues to rise and becomes a peer competitor with the United States, it does lie in the US's interest to ensure that China cannot take complete control over that oil. However, that does not necessitate American hegemony in the Middle East. It necessitates that America has a military posture that prevents China from becoming the military hegemon of the Middle East. That is a very different military posture than the one that we currently have. An offshore balancing position that would be far less costly, would not get itself involved and entangled in all of the different conflicts of the region, because it's not about the value of the region to the United States, it's about the potential value of the region to China. But that's not the posture that we're taking right now. And the Chinese, I think, are quite content that we have entangled ourselves in these conflicts and seem to have great difficulty getting out of it. To the extent that I remember talking to a Chinese diplomat, and this is years ago, you can imagine what they would say now. And I pushed him a little bit and said, Lee, you know, come on, admit it, you're happy. The US is making itself weaker by doing these wars and you're benefiting from it. And he said, yes, but we're worried that the US will decline faster than China can rise. Tells you something.
Yeah, I mean, I think one also can ask legitimately whether United States policy in the post-World War II period, and particularly over the last, say, 30 years or so, with regard to oil and securing access to oil and so on, has actually been successful. I don't know if it has been successful. I'm actually, you know, I think there's been a tremendous cost. And what has that cost been? Well, it's been a number of things. I mean, one arguably could say that if the United States policy towards Iran had been significantly different from 1953 going forward, we wouldn't be on the stage today talking about Iran and the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and what's going on in the region. If United States policy had been different, we might not have MBS chopping people up in Istanbul and doing all kinds of other things. Certainly the security threat, right, the hostility directed at the United States by people in the region and elsewhere, I think would be significantly lower than it is today. And one thinks about the tremendous resources that the United States has spent and is continuing to spend fighting terrorism, the global war on terrorism and so on. So I'm not even convinced that, you know, in the post-World War II period, our policy has been successful, nor should we continue with the same kind of policy.
I just want to conclude with before passing this to Trita, to sort of sum up for us his last thoughts. I fear that we're going to see a lot more of this escalation. Iran is under tremendous pressure. We can see it internally, we see it externally. It's not going to let itself be starved to death without escalating. It's going to have to escalate because it's under tremendous economic pressure. And just because the United States isn't attacking it militarily doesn't mean that it isn't under attack economically. And so I think those two quotes I gave you from the president and the foreign minister of Iran both underline the fact that they're determined, that they're not just going to go silently into starvation. They're going to fight back because they've been cornered and there is no off-ramp for Iran. There is no way that it can fulfill America's objectives, which are to change the nature and the regime. And so we're headed towards greater conflict. I'm sure Iran now is praying that elections will bring them relief, but if it doesn't, if Trump wins, then we're going to see a real escalation in the region because Iran's not likely to want to take four more years of this. And that's the I think, the big worry. And Iran is I've said America can crush Iran, but Iran is a major country with a lot of resources. This is not 1953 when we can overturn the regime with $3 million. It's a different world. And China and Russia and others have a lot at stake not to let Iran collapse. And even many Europeans are beginning to side with Iran, if not economically, at least emotionally. They don't want to see Iran get bullied by the United States because they believe they're going to be the next ones to be bullied. And that's the bad situation, it seems to me, for the United States, is to lose allies over a struggle like this. Thank you.
I agree with you fully. If you have a re-election of Trump, I think he will feel far more empowered to triple down on this economic warfare policy. And that will likely beget even more intense resistance from the Iranians. And mindful of the fact that there is no exit ramp, war would become very, very likely. But I would also like to throw out just a thought about what if there is a different president on the American side. I hope that this would actually then provide an opportunity for the country as a whole to reassess what American leadership globally does and should mean. For the last 25 years, the very idea of America as a leader has become intertwined with the concept of American military hegemony. In fact, most people in Washington do not any longer understand what the difference is between American military hegemony and American leadership. This is a conceptual problem. We are suffering from a conceptual deficit. I think for the United States, it is essential, particularly with the new generation of Americans, who it's very fascinating to see that they're not adhering to some of these concepts of American exceptionalism, etc., to really start seriously think about how can American leadership manifest itself without American military hegemony? Because that's the only possible path for American leadership in this century. It's not going to be able to continue to dominate militarily while actually having leadership. In fact, that military domination is going to beget a lot of counter pressure, not just from countries like Iran, but as Joshua mentioned, from allies like Europe as well. And that's not a world I think we should be moving towards, and an opportunity to change that starts off with us actually reimagining what American leadership would mean. Thank you.
You've been listening to Iran-U.S. Conflict, What's Next for the Region? A public forum held February 3rd at the Sam Noble Oklahoma Museum of Natural History, and featuring commentary from author and Middle East analyst Trita Parsi, who serves as executive director of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, which advocates for what it calls, quote, ideas that move U.S. foreign policy away from endless war and towards vigorous diplomacy in the pursuit of international peace. Joining Mr. Parsi were Samer Shahada, associate professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and Joshua Landis, professor of Middle Eastern History and director of the OU Center for Middle East Studies, which sponsored the event. Our thanks to each of the speakers for their insights and presentation, and thanks also to the Sam Noble Museum staff who recorded today's forum. You'll find this discussion on our website at kgou.org. Just scroll to the Sunday Radio Matinee tab under Programs. The views expressed in today's forum are not necessarily those of the University of Oklahoma or of the staff of KGOU Radio. For KGOU, I'm Jim Johnson. Thanks for listening.